So, it's my pleasure to introduce, at this point, today's speaker. Today's talk is co-sponsored by MSU's program of African American and African Studies, which is headed by Kiki Adozie, who could not join us today because she's out of town, but Kiki was very, very fired up about today's address. Michael Honey has spoken in our Brown Bag series before, so it's great to have Michael back. Michael was raised here in this area. He was actually raised in Williamston, got a degree from Oakland University along the way, and has become one of the top scholars in both labor history and in civil rights history, and the intersection of those two. Probably most famous for his last book, Going Down Jericho Road, The Memphis Strike, Martin Luther King's Last Campaign, which is an exhaustive and wonderfully written look at that pivotal strike and King's involvement and King's assassination. So please do check that out. I'll send that around. Mike is the Haley Endowed Professor of the Humanities at the University of Washington, Tacoma. And he's always happy to try to find a way home, which is a great thing. His father was a professor on this campus of urban planning for a number of years before his retirement. So it's in many ways that Michael is in that way one of our own. So please help me in welcoming Michael Honey.
So. What I wanted to do is kind of a little bit of a mishmash in a way, but making it maybe a little more interesting. Last spring, we had this. I took my coat off because I was too hot, but there's a button here. We are one. Respect our rights. That was in response to the what happened in Madison, Wisconsin, Ohio, Michigan, rolling back public employee rights, and a big campaign there. And on that day, April 4th, which was the day Dr. King was killed in Memphis, we had a call to action, and we had events in 1,000 different communities on April 4th, sponsored by unions mostly, but also community organizations. So it was kind of the precursor to the We Are the 99%. It was, you know, I'm sure you remember, a huge eruption around the Madison situation. And people saw that as an important moment to organize and try to fight back against really an effort by Republican leaders around the country to utterly destroy public employee unions in the name of fiscal responsibility. And as I'm sure you know, Dr. King died in the middle of a strike of public employees, namely sanitation workers in Memphis, for the right to belong to a union. And so I was called on at that time because of this book, Going Down Jericho Road, and I spoke at the AFL-CIO National Office in Washington, D.C., and at Morehouse College in Atlanta, and at the Martin Luther King Center for Nonviolent Social Change in Atlanta. And in fact, I spent a lot of the year traveling around speaking. This book came out 4 years ago, but also this book came out in January of this year, All Labor Has Dignity, which is Martin Luther King's speeches to unions. And so I'm going to sample a little bit of both of those and talk about both of those books a little bit, but importantly, the history that they represent. And I've got a few kind of DVD things I'd like to use. And so hopefully I'll talk for about 35 minutes or 40 minutes, and then we can have discussion. We have till 1:15, is it? 1:30? Okay, great. So... April 4th was a really important time because in Memphis, people have been recognizing that anniversary every year with marches as the joining of the civil rights and the labor movement in 1968. And I'll work my way through that story a little bit in talking. But most people aren't really aware of what that history is about or the significance of it. King has been sort of narrowed down to, quote, civil rights leader instead of human rights leader. Anybody who follows this, you know, knows the scenario and the problem, which is that every year on the Martin Luther King holiday, students hear "I Have a Dream" over and over again, to the point where they must think he was sleeping in the 60s or something, because he's always having this dream. And that freezes him in time in 1963. And 1963 was the high point of the civil rights campaign in Birmingham, Alabama, and other places, starting with first Montgomery and then Albany, Georgia, and numerous campaigns in various communities. And King's strategy was pretty simple, which was to create massive disruption through nonviolent direct action at the places where segregation had an obvious public impact, namely schools, stores, places where people walked, challenging the whole Jim Crow framework in the South, which basically put black people in a position of people with no voting rights, couldn't sit on juries, couldn't be judges. There were few black lawyers in the South, black teachers, of course, but the black schools were incredibly underfunded and terrible for the most part. So that a lot of in Memphis, the place I know the best, for a long time there was no black high school. Then there was only one black high school. Then when they desegregated, what they did was fired a lot of the black teachers and put the black students in white schools sitting in the back of the class. And so there was this huge, long fight about civil rights. And that issue goes back to the Civil War and slavery. And so the I Have a Dream speech is profound. I mean, there is a reason why people keep coming back to it, which was that the United States was supposedly founded on this ideal of equal rights and citizenship rights. And of course, with that would be the right to vote and the right to participate in civic life just like anybody else. And that came to a head during the Civil War when African Americans in the South went on a general strike. W.E.B. Du Bois called it. They just refused to be slaves anymore, and they left the plantations. They went into the Union Army lines. 200,000 black soldiers fought in the Civil War. Crucial battles at the end of the war where basically the Union was failing, and this infusion of black troops helped to turn the tide. And out of that came the 13th Amendment abolishing slavery, the 14th Amendment guaranteeing equal rights and due process, which made citizenship national. So it doesn't matter if you're in Mississippi, you have the same rights as somebody living in Michigan, and it doesn't matter if your skin is black, you have the same rights as somebody whose skin is white. And that includes everything. It makes your citizenship national. And the 14th Amendment is what they've been trying to get rid of ever since, you know. And for 100 years under Jim Crow, they basically did get rid of it, which is that they passed all sorts of laws that went directly against the 14th Amendment, and the Supreme Court let it happen. And the most famous decision was the Plessy versus Ferguson in 1896, which said that these divisions by race are just local customs. They don't challenge the 14th Amendment. Your 14th Amendment rights don't include the right to go to a school or to use a restaurant or a bathroom or any of the things that would just be taken as normal as part of your rights as a citizen, as long as they were separate but equal. And of course, this was an entire fiction. I mean, there was nothing equal about separate. And in the Brown decision in 1954, overturning this doctrine, of course, the Supreme Court said separate is inherently unequal. It's putting somebody off to the side like they've got leprosy or there's something wrong with them. That's inherently unequal. And then they went through all the social statistics about how this worked out in practice, that African Americans had higher mortality rates, they had way higher unemployment rates, they had bad educational backgrounds, so it was difficult to get skilled jobs. And in any case, they were blocked from getting any skilled jobs in the first place by both Jim Crow statutes and by the practices of unions and employers. And so they created a socioeconomic composite to argue for an end to separate but equal. And then following that, we got the Civil Rights Act of 1964 through these various struggles that Dr. King was part of that enforced the 14th Amendment. And following that, we got the voting rights struggle in Selma, Alabama, another famous incident that occurred with Dr. King's leadership, to get the Voting Rights Act, which reinforced the 15th Amendment, which said that all males had the right to vote, regardless of color or national origin or religion. Of course, women weren't included in that until the amendment giving women the vote during the Progressive Era. So this arc of social movements leading to change from Montgomery bus boycott in 1955 to the Voting Rights Act of 64 and the Civil Rights Act of 65 was indeed a historic change. And what it did was to make the gains that were, you know, won through almost 600,000 people being slaughtered in the Civil War, to make those gains real in American life. And the problem becomes then that Dr. King and the movement he's part of then has been reified or sort of frozen in place, that we solve those problems. Those problems are gone. Not that they're gone entirely, but they're seen as if there's something wrong, if people have African Americans or other people of color are disadvantaged some way, this is something we're fixing, and we've basically changed the landscape. And so now we have equal opportunity for everyone. And so we have somebody like, what's his name, Beck? What's his first name? Glenn Beck, yes. Who, you know, did an I Have a Dream speech at the Lincoln Memorial a year ago on August 28th, which was when that speech happened in 1963, basically trying to adopt the mantle of Martin Luther King to his conservative cause, which says basically, you know, no social intervention on behalf of poor people or working people, and turn everything over to the free market. And yet this is in the name of civil rights and equality and justice. So the problem with this is that a lot of people don't really understand King's framework that he was organizing from, which was that he saw this 10-year period of the Montgomery bus boycott in 55 to the Voting Rights Act in 65 as what he called phase one of the freedom movement. And he never took the position that civil rights would solve the problems for African Americans. He said that, you know, civil rights, fighting for civil rights, we're only fighting for something that should have been ours to begin with. That is, national citizenship rights were granted in the 14th Amendment. So why 100 years later are people, you know, picketing and being shot and arrested and dying for those basic rights that we already have in the Constitution? And as this struggle developed, he kept pointing out to people over and over again that it wasn't just about civil rights, it was also about jobs. and it was also about economic issues. And anybody with a brain, you know, living at that time would know this. The NAACP would know this. The ACLU would know. Everybody would know this. But the question is, where can you make some advances in the law? And so the advances in the law were civil rights gains. But King repeatedly said, we also need a Bill of Rights for the disadvantaged. He called it an economic Bill of Rights. We need a Marshall Plan for the cities, as after World War II, where the U.S. infused money into Europe to get its economy going again. He said we need to do that with the cities. He always had an economic plan to move to a larger kind of socioeconomic justice that wasn't just defined by civil rights. And so he called that phase two of the freedom movement. And that's largely what these two books that I've done are about, is trying to understand what the whole phase two thing was. And it comes to a head in our own time, and I've been really kind of amazed at the timing of these things. This book, All Labor Has Dignity, King's Labor Speeches, came out just in time for the big conflict over public employee union rights in Madison and other places. And ironically, or maybe not ironically, I don't know, but Scott Walker, the governor of Wisconsin, attacked those very rights that King and the sanitation workers had won in 1968. First of all, the right to collective bargaining, which is sacrosanct. I mean, if you're in a union and you can't bargain for rights, your union is useless, right? I mean, they say, well, you can bargain for something, but you can't change your wage. This is what the legislation in Wisconsin did. You can't bargain over wage rates. You can't change the rules at the place of work. You know, your average worker would say, well, why would I want to be part of that union? Because it can't do anything for me, really. And so if you make collective bargaining some very narrow thing that you just sign off on a piece of paper, but it doesn't mean anything, that means you're going to destroy those unions. Secondly, he found a way to destroy the unions that Henry Loeb used in Memphis, the mayor of Memphis, which was to deny you the right to union dues checkoff. So, you know, the right-wing version of this is that the union shouldn't make you pay union dues. You should do this of your own volition, voluntarily, and so forth. But the reality is, especially for poor workers, if you have to collect the dues from them one by one, you'll never get most of those dues. Because in Memphis, the workers in sanitation made $1.60 an hour. And they lived below the poverty level, working 60 and 70 hours a week. And so if you go to them and say, okay, can you pay your $1 union dues this month? They say, I'm sorry, my pockets are empty. And so the only way to deal with that situation is to institutionalize it so that you get a, first of all, you have collective bargaining rights so that you can raise your wages. And second, that your union dues automatically come out so that the union has a financial base to operate from. And again, the right-wing version would be, well, they're exploiting you, they're taking your money away. You know, I mean, workers hear this all the time. It's a third party entering into a relationship between the employer and the worker, and they're just parasites taking your money away. And so Scott Walker in Wisconsin used this same line of attack on unions to get rid of both collective bargaining and union dues deduction. And they won both of those issues in Memphis. And it took 6 weeks. And it took the death of Martin Luther King to make it happen. It was not, they probably never would have won any of that strike if it had not been for King coming there. When he came there, it was almost at a standoff. And the mayor never, Mayor Loeb never did sign an agreement in Memphis. He finally let the city council make an agreement. And the city council had been trying to make an agreement, but he kept stopping them from doing it. And after Dr. King was assassinated in Memphis, you probably remember where you were when that happened. Most people do. If you think about John F. Kennedy or Robert F. Kennedy or Malcolm X or Martin Luther King, you might have a remembrance of where you were, unless you were, you know, not around yet and were born later. But I remember that very sharply in Oakland University in 1968. We'd had the huge Detroit riot the year before that, or we called it a rebellion, that basically shut the city down. We had another rebellion in 68, and it happened in 135 cities across the country. The federal government called out 50,000 troops to suppress domestic rebellion after King's assassination. The biggest use of federal troops to suppress domestic rebellion since the Civil War. And many cities went up in flames. Many people were killed in places all over the country. And despite that, Henry Loeb refused to sign an agreement in Memphis. And the president, Lyndon Johnson, sent down the head of the negotiations at the Labor Department and basically went around Loeb to the city council and signed this agreement. But of course, you know, looking at it historically, it's about much more than signing an agreement in Memphis. I mean, what historians try to do is understand the larger context and dimensions and significance of some major event like that. And interestingly, before I did this Going Down Jericho Road book, there was no major book on this. A woman named Joan Turner Bifus, an English professor who was involved in the strike, had written an account of it. But it wasn't a historical account, and it didn't have footnotes and all that. What had happened, actually, was that David Garrow, Taylor Branch, and other people had written magnificently about King's life in huge volumes, and you probably are aware of these books. And there's tons of stuff written about King. But Memphis was just seen as a backdrop. This is where he was killed. End of story. And so people didn't see it as being comparable to the Montgomery bus boycott, for example, which was the opening gun of the freedom movement in the first phase from 55 to 65. So there have been a lot of books written about Montgomery, but not about Memphis, partly because King was killed and it was such a bummer. It was such a bad story. And secondly, because the framework remained this one of it's all about the civil rights movement, phase one. Well, King going to Memphis and getting killed in a strike doesn't quite resonate with phase one. You know, why is that about civil rights? So people would tend to see it as, well, this was just an odd occurrence. King, you know, was in Memphis and that's where he was killed. Could have been killed anywhere. Of course, he could have been killed anywhere. But why did he go to Memphis? Why was he willing to put his life on the line in Memphis? Everybody knew when he went to Memphis that it was a very dangerous situation. The strike had gotten out of, it had turned into basically a war between the black community and the city government. And King stepped into that situation knowing that it was very, very volatile. And in fact, several times when he went back to Memphis, there were threats on his life that if he went, he would be killed. And we know now that James Earl Ray was following him from place to place. And, you know, to just give you an idea of how dangerous it was, the day that he was killed, April 4th, 1968, I found this in the FBI records. There were 40 police cars circling that part of Memphis in concentric circles, and not a single one was near King protecting him. He had no police protection. That morning, the Memphis Commercial Appeal, or the night before, maybe the Press Summiter also, put in the newspaper where he was staying and what the room number was. So I believe it was James Earl Ray that pulled the trigger. Other people don't think so. Andrew Young and many people with King believe it was a larger conspiracy. I'm not trying to settle that issue, but what was very clear was that the people who ran things in Memphis were antagonistic to King, did nothing to protect King, and that the Memphis media, which was extremely hostile to the strike and gave a totally one-sided story, anti-union story, just basically gave an invitation to anybody, here's where King is if you want to find him. And if you ever go to the National Civil Rights Museum in Memphis, it's astonishing. It's a great, important place to go. You go through all the exhibits, and you end up at King's room looking out on the balcony where he was shot. And from there, you can just look up the hill, and you can see the rooming house from which he was shot. And if you go outside and walk through a tunnel, it takes you right up to that room. I was just there in August. We're renovating the whole Civil Rights Museum, so they brought scholars in to look at the renovations that they're doing. And you can walk, you can't walk into the room, they've got it glassed off, but you can look, you can see the bathtub upon which the shooter stood and the window, and you look out the window, and about 60 yards, there's room 103 where King was shot. It was easy. Anybody could have done it. You know, anybody could have shot him from that room. And yet, they had police swarming the district. There was a fire department building right next to the rooming house. There were police in there. And when he was shot, they all came running out, and they ran toward where King was. And, of course, Andrew Young and other people and Jesse Jackson said, well, the shot was from over... You know, you see that famous picture where King's laying on the balcony, and people are going like that. And what they're doing is they're telling the police, don't come here, go there. That's where the shot was. And so people I interviewed said, well, anybody would know. If you hear a shot, you go to where the shot came from. You can hear where the shot happened. Instead, they went to the target. Anyway, to put it bluntly, most African Americans in Memphis do not believe that it was just one person doing it, that there was a conspiracy with the police. In going down Jericho Road, and again, I'm being sort of neutral on this because I can't prove anything, but if you read going down Jericho Road and you look at what the FBI was doing, J. Edgar Hoover had a concerted campaign to extinguish King from American life. Interestingly, it started with the March on Washington in 1963 when they had that huge, 250,000 people event. At that time, Hoover said, this man has too much power, we've got to stop him. And that's when they broke into his office and put in wiretaps. They broke into the offices of his lawyers and put in wiretaps. Had King followed by agents pretty much everywhere he went. And so the FBI was all over the case, but where were they when he was shot? They were there, but they weren't doing anything to protect King. Similarly, the Military Intelligence Division was there of the U.S. Army, which was also following King. And they were sitting there in the firehouse when he was shot. So this could be a diversion to get off into that, but I guess what I would say about it is that when King went to Memphis, he was among the circles of power an extremely unpopular person who they wanted to silence. Lyndon Johnson really dropped King completely when he came out against the Vietnam War in 1967, April 4th, 1967, 1 year before he was killed. And so King had the paramilitary right wing against him because he came out against the war. I remember living at Oakland University in Rochester. This guy named Donald Lobsinger had a group in Detroit that was a far right, kind of neo-Nazi group. And when King tried to speak in Grosse Pointe, they shouted him down on March 10th, right before he came to Memphis. And I can remember that happening to us when we would have demonstrations. It was called Operation Breakthrough, and they might beat the hell out of you, or at least they would harass you. So there was that kind of right-wing fervor among military, paramilitary people. At the same time, there was the segregationist movement in the South, which always wanted to kill King. And then beyond that was the officialdom, you know, of the Lyndon Johnson administration, the FBI, the Military Intelligence Division. So he steps into this situation in Memphis, and he has also the city government and the police against him on that. So there's so many things to talk about in this, but what I want to really focus on is the labor part of it. In 1965, after the Voting Rights Act was passed, King took a different direction. And he said, now we're going to do phase two of the freedom movement. So he went to Chicago in 1966, and he tried to break open the segregated housing patterns in Chicago and the segregated employment patterns. And in 1967, he came out against the war. He said, one of his main points about the war in Vietnam was not just that it was a horrendous war, which it was. I mean, and myself, I was following King all through this, and he said, if you're of draft age, refuse. And so I did, with many other people. He said, this is not a war you should fight in. You shouldn't fight in any war, but particularly not in this one. And so that was also, it was on a moral basis, but in addition, it was an economic issue. The cities were burning, lack of economic programs. He kept demanding, you know, we need a Marshall Plan for the cities. We need an economic bill of rights. We need a $50 billion infusion. Nobody's listening to any of that from King. And he said, why? Well, the money's going to Vietnam. You know, there was a tax increase under Lyndon Johnson. Unlike George Bush, he actually tried to pay for his war. And the result was that all the money was going down the drain of the military establishment. So King then took the position that, one, it's wrong, and two, it's making it impossible to make any changes to the black condition in America, which is socioeconomic as much as it is political and civil rights legislation. So then, in early 1968, he launched what he called the Poor People's Campaign. And the Poor People's Campaign was, it's a very simple thing to comprehend. We're going to take people to Washington, poor people from all over the country, and we're going to demand a radical reordering of priorities. That was King's words. A radical reordering of priorities. Namely, we're going to shift money from military appropriations to domestic issues. And those domestic issues are going to be jobs and job training, education, and shoring up incomes of poor people and medical care. Five things that we are dealing with right now, pretty much in the same proportion, you know, that we need what he called a radical reordering of priorities. 40-some years later, it's still where we are. And so he went into Memphis as part of his Poor People's Campaign. He was traveling around the country trying to organize people for this campaign. And people asked him to come to Memphis to support this strike, and the people on his campaign staff said, you know, we really can't do that. We don't have time. You'll get into that situation and it'll bog you down, which is exactly what happened. And he said, well, how can I be saying that I want a movement for poor people's rights? And here is a movement for poor people's rights. It's called the labor movement. It's among the people who work. demanding union rights, and they have to have union rights in order to bring up their wages and their conditions. So how can I not go to Memphis? I would be like a hypocrite if I didn't go. And so that's how he ended up being there. And out of that came a very important story that has been sort of lost for the last 40-some years, which is that labor rights are civil rights. You know, if you don't have any power on the job to change anything about your condition, you're essentially without civil rights. If they can fire you on the spot, you're without civil rights. If they can hold you in captive audience meetings, like suppose we all work, you know, let's say this is MSU factory and we're all brought to lunch here by the employer and told about how don't join that AFSCME union or that SEI union or whoever it is. That's a captive audience meeting. Your job depends on coming to this meeting. That's not supposed to happen. According to the Wagner Act of 1935, employers can't do those things, but they do all the time in the United States. And essentially, we've lost most of the rights that the Wagner Act gave us in 1935. And, you know, this is extremely crucial to the situation now, because the reason Franklin Roosevelt supported the Wagner Act was he said that part of the problem with the economic depression is that people are making so little money or don't have jobs, but those who do have jobs are making so little money, they can't afford to buy the products that they produce. And he was a free market person in a certain sense. He said, the easiest way to solve this problem is to give people union rights, and then they'll solve it for themselves. In other words, if you have rights on the job and can organize a union, you'll fight for whatever you can get. The government doesn't have to step in. It doesn't have to be mandated by somebody else. You do it yourself. And out of that, wages will come up. And then he said, if I were a worker, I'd join a union. You know, and they made this a big slogan. And that's how the CIO, Congress of Industrial Organizations, UAW, auto workers, steel workers, chemical workers, the vast array of industrial unions, that's how they got moving, was they finally got rights on the job. And that's pretty much what we have lost, and you've seen those union statistics dropping and dropping ever since, to now there's only about 9% of people in private employment that belong to unions. The place where it changed was when Dr. King and the civil rights movement joined with the labor movement in 1968. And that opened up public employee organizing. Jerry Wirth became the president of the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees in 1964. He was a civil rights advocate. He saw these two issues as joined at the hip. And he put everything he had into that Memphis strike. AFSCME didn't start the strike. The workers started the strike. They just walked off the job. And if you read this book, it's very dramatic. Essentially, two workers get ground up in a garbage truck, and that's kind of the last straw. They go out on strike in February. You don't go out on strike in sanitation in February. You go out in August when the garbage is going to pile up and it's going to smell. You know, you put pressure on the city very fast. They walked out in February because they said, we've had enough. We can't take this anymore. And it was a lot like the Montgomery bus boycott. Monday, they had a meeting on Sunday night and said, we're not going to work tomorrow. Somehow the word got spread through 1,300 sanitation workers. Monday morning, the drivers showed up, but no workers showed up. Nobody would go to work. And that went on for 6 weeks. So it's a dramatic story, very much like the Montgomery bus boycott. And it involves a couple of police riots. It involves King being assassinated. It involves other people being killed by the police. And yet, people don't really know much about it. Most people don't. And they don't know why it's important, because we've sort of lost that whole context of what King said was phase two of the freedom movement. That is not just about civil rights and voting rights. It's about economic what he called economic equality. And interestingly, I'll finish in a minute here, but interestingly, I'm finding in watching the, you know, we are the 99% Occupy movement, this term is starting to pop up all over the place among analysts and among movement organizers, the term economic equality. I thought, wow, where did I hear that? And it's in this book, King's Speech to the Memphis Sanitation Strikers in 1968. He says, the title for this book, All Labor Has Dignity, comes from this speech. And he says, the importance of sanitation is just as important as the work of the doctor. Without, you know, Memphis had a series of yellow fever epidemics in the 19th century for lack of sanitation. And he talks about the need for union rights as a way to get economic justice. And then he uses this term, economic equality. And he was doing it, if you read these labor speeches, you'll see all throughout this discourse that he has, which is basically an economic framework for social justice and civil rights. And one of the things that was important to me was to discover these speeches. I found these at the Martin Luther King Center for Nonviolent Social Change in their library a long time ago, like in 1992. And I spent 10 years researching and writing this book, but I always had these speeches sitting to the side thinking, boy, somebody should do something with these speeches. Because there are a lot of books of King's speeches, but these speeches are not in those books. And so, lo and behold, Beacon Press comes to me and says, we know you're a scholar on King and labor. Would you edit a book of King's labor speeches? And they knew about it because I had told them that there were these speeches, you know. But it's very difficult to do things with the King family because they're so copyright conscious and everything. But it turned out Beacon Press made a deal with the King family to reproduce all his writing. And so I don't get any royalties from this book. It all goes to the King family. So they just paid me a fee, basically, to do this. And so here's one of these speeches. There's something wrong. This is 1962. This is not 1968 at the end. This King is saying these things all the way through these speeches, starting in 1957. This is to the Distributive Workers Union in New York City. First of all, he gives the analysis that he gives so clearly with the Vietnam War. There are three major social evils that are alive in the world today. These evils are the evil of war, the evil of economic injustice, and the evil of racial injustice. And he goes on to say that these three things are all intertwined. You can't solve the problem of poverty unless you solve the problem of constant warfare and spending your money on war. And you can't solve the problem of racial injustice without solving the problem of economic injustice, too. He says there's something wrong with a situation that will take necessities from the masses and give luxuries to the classes. Right here in America, 0.1% of the population controls almost 50% of the wealth. Some changes must take place here. And he says, we've seen racial injustice, but not only have we seen it in the South, no section of the country is clean. It's an economic problem all over the country. Speaking in Illinois in 1965 at the AFL-CIO convention, he says, there is a more difficult challenge than the one we face in the South. For now, we will not be dealing with constitutional rights. We will be dealing with fundamental human rights. It's a constitutional right for a person to be able to vote, but the human right to a decent house is as categorically imperative and morally absolute as was that constitutional right. It is not a constitutional right that people have jobs, but it is a human right. So the challenge, I think, of King's discourse is to reconnect our brain with what he was really talking about And to recognize this phase one, phase two, as a basic framework for analysis of where we are today. And also to recognize that unions are crucial to solving these problems. It's not accidental that the right-wing movement in the country has targeted unions. The Koch brothers have put tons of money into destroying unions. And it's because they're trying to remove one of the fundamental building blocks for social action. You can think, well, unions are very, you know, down now. But 12 million people belong to unions. It's the one of the few things that we have that where people are actually organized to do something and actually can funnel some money into political campaigns. And, of course, this is one reason to get rid of them. Then they can't support candidates anymore. And also, it's a fundamental thing for people's rights at the place of work. And it's really all about this problem of the 1%, or 1/10 of 1%, hogging the wealth in the country and the vast economic disparities that we're living with. So let me just finish with this little DVD, and then we'll have discussion. Is this going to work? Oh. Oh, we've lost
and
our screen.
Please do sign in if you haven't already signed in. And let me just say while we're queuing this up that Michael's speaking tonight at Schuler's Books in Okemos at 7 o'clock, where they will have books available, which isn't true of us right now.
Okay.
Schuler's in Okemos?
Schuler's in Okemos, 7 o'clock tonight.
Okay, I'm going to finish with this. Okay, there we go. One way I like to hook up these histories is through music. I had a set of slides that I didn't show you, but about the civil rights movement in the early 60s. And this is 1968. And I was using the same songs in both sets of slides. And this is taking you through the strike in Memphis. I'm not going to narrate that strike. It would take too long. But here's what they sang. I woke up this morning with my mind stayed on freedom. I woke up this morning with my mind. Then they sang it in their mass meeting. Stayed on freedom. I woke up this morning with my mind stayed on freedom. Hallelujah, hallelujah, hallelujah. Walking and talking with my mind stayed on freedom. Walking and talking with my mind stayed on freedom. Walking and talking with my mind stayed on freedom. Hallelujah, hallelujah, hallelujah. I said we shall not, you know that we shall not be moved. Oh, we shall not, we shall not be moved, just like a tree planted by the water. We shall not be moved. You know we're fighting for our unions, and we shall not be moved. You know we're fighting for our unions, and we shall not be moved, just like a tree planted by the water. Oh, we shall not be moved. Oh, freedom. Oh, freedom. Oh, freedom over me. And before I'd be a slave, I'd be buried in my grave and take my place with those who loved and fought before. Take my place with those who loved and fought before. So those were three songs that were used in the 1930s during the movements of labor, and came up again in the 1960s during the civil rights movement, and came up again in this movement in 68. And I like to use that as an illustration of how social movements connect over time. I don't know how that happened. I don't know why people knew these songs, or if they understood that the Southern Tenant Farmers Union, which I'm writing a book about now, had used these songs in the 30s. But from generation to generation, it somehow got passed along. And so I guess, you know, just in conclusion is that I can tell you I've got about 3 hours more of stuff I could talk to you about, but I won't. That I guess my mission is to basically fundamentally get people to recognize the unity of these issues and the importance of connecting them. Just one last thing, and then I have some discussion. I'm reading this book right now called There is Power in a Union by Philip Dre, The Epic Story of Labor in America. And it's very good, you know, and it takes you back to the Lowell girls and the textile mills in Massachusetts. But it's basically an image of white people as labor. There's no black people in here. And it's I can't believe it as I'm reading it. You can see that he's more of a journalist. A labor historian would never write a book like this these days, because our scholarship has gone so far beyond that. And that's the problem we have with King. The scholarship on labor and civil rights is way beyond the public knowledge. And so I consider it sort of like my duty to go around talking about this and try to get people started reading these things. So I'll finish, and that's... Yeah.
I work for Michigan Education Association, so I represent K-12 employees. And obviously our teachers are under attack in big ways, and our school employees are under attack. Has there been any labor history done of essentially the women's perspective of the labor movement on that side? Because right now, particularly I think race is an issue in the sense that they're taking over our large urbans by the emergency financial manager. They're also taking our large urbans by the way they gutted the collective bargaining right laws that they can nullify contracts in failing schools, which are predominantly our minority school districts too. So is there any, I guess, tie-in of what they're, because it's one of the places women had equal pay for equal work, and they lost just cause in this last round of legislation. So I mean, we're going backwards in so many ways for women.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's anything to speak about that a little bit.
There's, along with civil rights history and labor history in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, a whole new group of scholars came in doing women's history. And there's a great body of work on women's labor history now. I think what's happening right now, what you're describing, we're in a kind of a special period, actually, that needs to be documented. There's so much going on. I travel around a lot, and things like that are happening everywhere I go, and in the state I live, Washington State, too. And so one of the important things is to document these things as they're happening, interview people. A lot of my work actually comes through interviews. I did a whole book called Black Workers Remember, which I just interviewed dozens of people about what they remembered, you know, of this history. So, there's a lot to read, but also we're in a time where these things are happening with the relationship between workers and the state that are, I won't say they're unprecedented, but it's a huge rolling back of the gains.
Well, they find it pretty easy to take out the women, predominantly women unions first. They didn't go after police and fire, and I got to work a few days in Ohio, and we did door-to-door Ohio, be like, that's our firefighter thing, right? Yeah, with the firefighters. So we're finding it a lot easier to take away bargaining rights for women before we go after anyone else and sort of, it's been done silently. People don't know, and they did it to the teachers and didn't do it to the support staff. So our bus drivers, our custodians, our parapros, all of them still have just cause, and our teachers don't. So it's an interesting, you go after the group that almost is silent because they're so philanthropic that nobody knows that that's what just happened.
Let me hit you with a hypothetical.
Okay.
You talk about phase two. Well, phase two happened in a way, and that is Abernathy's march on. I mean, there was ultimately a march on Washington, the poor people's city, and the whole thing. Do you believe that King was possibly going to turn a tide? Because I think one argument would be make that he was really talking about class, not race. And the race was an easy conversation for some people because it was about what was happening in the South, even though conditions were so bad in the North. But class was going to be a discussion about, you know, really the fundamental capitalist kind of thing in America. Do you believe that if King had not died, that there would have been, how do you look at the conjecture around what would have happened to phase two?
Yeah. You know, from a present perspective, I find that people have a harder time talking about class than race. I teach civil rights history, too, and labor history. Civil rights history, people are quite open to learning about what happened, and when they find out what happened, they're just unbelievably appalled. Like, how come I didn't know this before, and about slavery and segregation and all that? But when you talk about labor issues, it's so much part of what's happening today, or economic and class. It's a real hard conversation to have. And I think that's the problem King was also having, you know, that he was joining these issues, and nobody except us in the movement and poor people wanted to hear that. So if he had lived, I think he would have been he was shunned already. And we did end up with Richard Nixon in 68. So, you know, it seems like the country shifted over in a bad way. I don't know what would have become of his movement, really.
My experience is that Dr. King was active in the peace movement, and that in this country we have a huge problem with violence and justification of violence.
Yeah.
And that is what ended his life, his violence, gun violence.
Yeah. Yeah, some of the people at the time, like Jesse Jackson, said, I'm not as concerned about who killed King as what killed King. And it was a general atmosphere of violence. And, you know, when you do the research, I've got in my going down Jericho Road things like that I found in the FBI files where some lunatic in Pennsylvania is writing to the head of the FBI that King is importing Remington rifles into the movement from a factory in Pennsylvania. And in the letter to Hoover, he says, I understand King is a communist. You know, I hear he's importing rifles and he's a communist. What are you going to do about this? Or can you disabuse me? If this is not true, please tell me it's not true. And Hoover said, communists are a big problem in the movement. He doesn't say you're nuts or this is totally wrong. He doesn't affirm it either, but he doesn't do anything to stop it. And that was the thing. I mean, and we're still in that crazy violence kind of framework.
It's gun violence.
Do you know that the laws to restrict guns came out of King's assassination, and those are the ones they're unwinding right now? This thing about, you know, they just passed in Congress that you can carry a gun from state to state, even if in the other state you're not allowed to carry a gun, but your gun rights in the other state have precedence.
Well, I didn't hear it said, but what I'm talking about is military violence.
Yeah, I mean, we're a militarized society. We're really a militarized society. I mean, I can hardly watch football anymore because that's so militarized. So, I mean, King would be very appalled. Yeah.
To me, if you're one in the process of organizing labor unions, the kind of thing we were talking about today, how does one translate that into a sense, a simpler message so that I can persuade somebody to join the union?
Uh-huh.
in today's society.
Yeah.
It's not really a matter of wages, obviously, to put it out.
Yeah. We need a different framework.
Yeah.
Yeah.
See, to me, that's the challenge.
Yeah. I think we're in a moment of re-education in a way. The 99%, the Occupy movement has finally broke open the issue of who's really making all the money and who's controlling the politics of the country. And, you know, it's not as simple as 99% versus 1%. But what they've done is shift the public rhetoric. And so I think we're in a period, and so did the movement around Madison, Wisconsin, that we're at a time where people can start to see things differently, maybe. And, you know, I don't know, in our society, we really have this thing where certain ideas get drummed in and then people sort of blindly follow them. And we've been, the right-wing message that we're all in this for ourselves, that we can't have group solutions to anything. Now that's really being questioned. So I think, you know, you or me or anybody talking to other people can just start to talk about the framework in a different way. And then people in their job situations or whatever, they'll find their own solutions. They'll find their own solutions. I just read that more people voted to throw out that bill in Ohio that took away public employee rights than voted for Governor Kasich when he was elected. So something's happening. There's a shift going on. It's a good time to talk to people.
This is a little bit ephemeral compared to the other questions you've been fielding, but I'm going to ask it anyway.
Uh-huh.
Talk about editing Dr. King's speeches. Did you find them collected? Were they easy to edit? What decisions did you make as you went through the editing process?
Oh, that's a good question. She asked, how was it to edit King's speeches? I mean, who has the nerve to edit King's speeches? I didn't edit them very much. I tried to select.
Were they all collected? Did somebody hand you a box of paper or what?
Yeah, somebody handed me a box of paper. They said, and it said on the outside, King's labor speeches. Boom. I said, what? King's labor speeches? I didn't know he had any. And that was 1992. And then I kept trying to find more. And so that's what we did with the book. If one speech completely duplicated another, we didn't use it. And sometimes we'd take out a few paragraphs because they were too repetitive or something. For instance, in that set of speeches, many times he ends with, I have a dream. He used that, you know, all the time. Long before he used it in D.C., he was saying that to unions. He was saying that to the AFL-CIO in 1961. I have a dream. That's how he would end his thing. So we tried not to keep repeating that over and over again, and we'd make a little note he finished with or something. But other than that, we tried not to tamper too much because, you know, who would do that? Not me. But you'll find, if you get that book, you'll find they're nice and short. They each have a theme. And then a lot of work that I did that was very rewarding was to write introductions to these speeches and explain what was going on and put it in a context. Rick? You know, one of the ironic things that happened was after the sanitation strike, that's when public employees finally won the right to unions in Memphis. They didn't have it before that. Who organized? The police. And they had a strike that was much more damaging than the sanitation strike. The police went out a couple years later, and everything got screwed up. And then the firefighters did the same thing. So, and during the march, James Lawson, who was one of the organizers, black minister, told me about he was marching and this white cop was right next to him and he said, how much do you make? And the guy was making minimum wage. He said, how many hours do you work? He said, 60, 70 hours a week. He said, you need a union. And they did. They unionized. And the Memphis police now are no longer all white men large percentage of women, large percentage of African Americans and Latinos. And so that's changed.
Another question I was going to ask was that in terms of why this historic opportunity for organizing that workers occurred in public context rather than private context. Uh-huh. I mean, didn't this come at the end of a 20-year drive to try and successfully organize across the South? Union organizing across the South and had been defeated.
Yeah.
And this, I mean, this looked like an opening where there mm-hmm. had been an opening.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a really important thing. My first book I wrote was about the CIO in the South in Memphis from 1935 to 55, basically. And they succeeded in organizing industrial unions in the North and then tried to do it in the South with a thing called Operation Dixie. And the police and the governors, and they really smashed it. They found that in the South, except for national companies like Firestone that moved to Memphis, which they did unionize, these local companies were totally intransigent. And they have these right-to-work laws that were introduced by the Taft-Hartley Act in 1947. So everything was against them. King says the right-to-work laws don't give you any rights and they don't give any work. And so public employee unions became a possibility that was more likely than in the private sector by the 1960s because of the civil rights movement, because a lot of black people worked in public employment. That was really the reason. It was there were black people with a civil rights consciousness now in positions of jobs where they could unionize. And so that was like the next wave of unionization.
Now, the next wave is going to be tonight at 7 o'clock. I have to tell you, unfortunately, we have to vacate the room for a meeting that's going to take place in a few minutes. So let's give Michael a hand, please.